Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
Today we've got three grab bars to install, a raised toilet seat, and we've got a bath mat and a fire extinguisher.
Could fixing people's houses improve their health? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. When you have a doctor's appointment these days, you're getting asked a lot of questions about your life. What do you eat? Do you exercise? Do you use drugs? How much do you drink? Do you feel safe at home? All of this is part of an effort to understand how things other than our blood pressure or cholesterol levels impact our health. But the big question is, if the answers paint an unhealthy picture, let's say a patient eats a lot of fast food, lives in a violent neighborhood, or sleeps every night in a moldy apartment, then what? In recent years, public health experts have turned their focus to fixes, big and small, that attempt to change these very conditions, creating green spaces for relaxation and exercise or bringing grocery stores to areas in need. Our reporter Tanya English has covered these trends in public health for years. Wonks call this social determinants of health. And for this story, she looked into the connection between health and wealth.
819.
Okay.
95.
Okay.
77.
Vanessa Moore is sitting with her financial coach, going over her monthly budget. There's rent, the cell phone, her 15-year-old needs back-to-school supplies. Plus, Moore just finished breast cancer treatment, so she has lots of medical bills.
Now, was it short before cancer?
No, I had hair down to my shoulders before chemotherapy. I was like, I'm not cutting my hair.
She wears a short afro now, and even that small expense has to be written down.
My son's like, Ma, you need a shape up. So I had to go to the barber, and that was $10.
Moore is learning to balance income and spending in a financial empowerment program called Stand By Me. The state of Delaware pays for the coaching, and trainer Maria Luna Medina teaches clients to watch every dime.
And according to the calculation, there's 193 left.
Oh.
Now, do you feel like you have that money extra or...
No.
No. Okay. Where do you think this may be going?
I don't know.
In real life, Moore's bank account is overdrawn. She feels the pressure, and she's really worried about her son.
He deals with this situation the best he can. He grew out of a pair of sneakers, and at the end of the school year, and instead of stressing me out about the sneakers, he took the insoles out of his sneakers, and he's been wearing them all summer. But it's what you get when you have bad credit, low income.
First, there was a costly divorce. After that, Moore missed lots of work because of depression and back pain, and eventually she lost her job. Then Moore was diagnosed with cancer. She lives on a Social Security disability check now. But when money's tight and the rent is due, Moore sometimes takes out a payday loan to make it to the end of the month. Financial coach Maria Luna Medina says that's a common and costly trap.
You know, part of her goal here with Vanessa is that she is able to control her money rather than her budget controlling what she's able to do.
Money management training is supposed to help launch poor people toward financial stability. And in Delaware, officials say they've come to realize that money problems can hurt health. Vanessa Moore says she had that same thought last year when she discovered a lump in her breast.
I don't know where it came from, but I know I've been under a lot of stress the last 6 years.
Public health professionals often use the analogy of dying fish in a river to explain the connections between poverty and health.
Your intervention might be to clean up the water in the immediate vicinity of where the fish are dying.
That's Jason Purnell, a health disparities professor at Washington University in St. Louis. He says a better strategy is to find out where the pollution starts. To help a community of unhealthy people, you have to consider the neighborhood influences, social policies, and other upstream problems that poison health. Segregation is one example. Denying home loans based on race isn't legal, but Purnell says discriminatory lending practices happen a lot.
The Justice Department announced today that Wells Fargo has agreed to pay $175 million to settle accusations of unfair and discriminatory lending practices to African Americans and Hispanics.
Low-income people often use home ownership to move out of poverty. But Justice Department investigations have shown that it's still harder for equally qualified African Americans and Hispanics to get a mortgage. That leaves whole groups cut off from wealth building and stuck in neighborhoods that are less likely to have nutritious food or safe parks where kids can play. Purnell says the consequences reach into the next generation.
There's something about the insult of poverty and stress to the developing child that is lingering and permanent.
To cope, stressed out people often use unhealthy habits like smoking, overeating, or watching too much TV. Purnell says financial health is public health, but he and other believers are still trying to educate the public and convince lawmakers.
Really take the conversation beyond this notion of medical care and personal responsibility.
So far, there's not a lot of proof that you can treat conditions of poverty to save healthcare dollars, but it's become a popular theory. On the West Coast, the California Endowment is a big investor. And in New Jersey, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation spends millions trying to design healthier neighborhoods. One recent study found huge differences in how long people live when they're born just a few miles apart. A child born in prosperous Princeton, New Jersey, can expect to live to age 87. In Trenton, New Jersey, where there's lots of poverty, the life expectancy is 71. Sarah Zanton is a professor at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. She says you can't move everyone to Princeton, New Jersey.
But we are finding we can do things around the edges. What is it about Princeton that is movable to Trenton?
Zanton is a researcher and a nurse. She says little things pile up over a lifetime, and she wants to tease out which things matter most to health.
We're just starting to understand the factors and to understand what's fixable.
And some of those public health findings have already been translated into real-world policy. In Maryland, state lawmakers boosted the amount of nutritional assistance available for older adults. And that was not too long after Zanton's team at Hopkins discovered that low-income seniors who get food stamps are less likely to end up in the hospital or a nursing home.
A lot of people have good ideas that never get implemented, never get put into action. And that's because there's no measurement about how much it costs and how much it saves.
That's Sarah Zanton's latest investigation. She's trying to figure out if some of those fixes pay off. She leads a project called Capable that sends a nurse and an occupational therapist into older people's homes to see how seniors are living. And a handyman goes along to do home repairs.
People get very excited about doorbells. In many cases, the doorbell they've got doesn't work or was taken out at some point. If an ambulance needs to come, then it's nice having a doorbell.
Gary Feltzer is the handyman, and he does similar work for the city of Baltimore.
Today, we've got 3 grab bars to install, a raised toilet seat, and we've got a bath mat and a fire extinguisher.
All kinds of stuff going in.
That's Christine. She has a straight back, amazing posture, and at age 88, not much seems to bother her. Even in the middle of a Baltimore summer with no air conditioning, she seems cool, and her snowy white hair is pinned in a neat bun. But she does worry about identity theft and senior scams, so we're just using her first name. Christine lives in the same 1920s bungalow where she and her husband raised 6 kids. But these days, it's harder to keep up with small repairs. Earlier this year, she almost slipped in the bathtub.
Okay, make it nice and easy for you to get in or out.
Christine is also getting new lights and a second banister in her cellar basement, so she can hold on as she walks down the steep wooden stairs.
Cut what I need for that, and then I get a piece of rail and get this thing happening.
More than 400 seniors have gotten similar help at home through the Capable program. Participants said they're better able to cook meals and get dressed in the morning. And after working with a nurse and the therapist, their strength and balance is better. Many said their depression lifted. The 4-month program, including home repairs, cost about $3,000 per person. In Maryland, the average hospitalization cost is $15,000. At Christine's bungalow, when the handyman's done with his work, the house is a little safer, and so is Christine as she heads down those wooden steps to do laundry.
It keeps you young, moving around.
I don't know about that.
Younger, how's that?
I don't know about that either. Let me say, it keeps me on the move.
Okay, well, that's good.
Tanya English reported this story. We've been talking about the impact of finances on our health, and our next story is about the tension that sometimes arises between medically sound and fiscally sound decisions. It's been a bit over 2 years since the first new drug for hepatitis C hit the market. Hepatitis C can destroy people's liver. It's the leading cause of liver cancer. So when this drug became available, it was nothing short of a miracle. Cure was suddenly a real option for people suffering with this illness without the terrible side effects that accompanied the older drugs. But this miracle cure came with a massive catch, a very high price tag. Our reporter Alana Gordon has been covering this new generation of Hep C drugs and the ensuing tug of war over costs, and she is here now with some new developments. Hi, Alana.
Hey, Mike. And yeah, you might have heard of these drugs. This is a $1,000 a day pill. What they actually cost, it's private information negotiated between insurers and drug companies, but it's a lot.
It is a lot. And the thing we've been hearing about is how states have been struggling with the cost of drugs like this for programs like Medicare and Medicaid. And your reporting this time took you to Delaware because there are some changes happening there.
It's an interesting place to be watching right now. And so some of the people that are being caught in the middle of this are patients like Valerie Green. Who's this?
This is Bella, my little Jack Russell.
I recently met up with her and her two dogs at her home in Millville, Delaware. It's about 2 hours south of Wilmington, near the beach. And for a long time, Green tells me she just wasn't feeling right. She had a lot of fatigue, nausea, and she just, again, didn't know what was going on. Finally, a specialist last year ran a bunch of blood tests, and one came back positive for hepatitis C.
I was like, wow, I really am sick. I knew it. I knew something was wrong. It was validation that, yes, I do have something wrong. And now let's see what we have to do to fix it.
How did she get it?
Well, it was a big shock for her, and she's not totally sure. Hepatitis C is transmitted through blood-to-blood contact, and you can go for decades without symptoms or knowing that you have it. So Green thinks that she may have gotten it from a blood transfusion when she had her son. That was 30 years ago, and that was before the blood supply was screened. In general, another big risk is injection drug use. So Green, she has Medicaid, and she was like, all right, now that I know what's up, let's deal with this. She applied for this new treatment. She was excited about it, but that didn't last long.
About 2 weeks later, we received our first denial. And that was based on I don't meet their recommendations of not being sick enough.
Hold on. What does that mean, not being sick enough? That sounds crazy.
Well, a lot of states like Delaware actually restrict who can get these drugs based on how damaged their liver is. Part of it is to prioritize who's the sickest. And so these states often use a scale, 0 to 4, 0 being mild to no liver damage, and 4 being the most cirrhosis, meaning really poor liver function. And that's not really good news for Valerie Green because her liver's still healthy.
You know you have a disease, and you know that day in and day out, your liver is progressively getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And you're not going to get any better until you have this drug to eradicate this virus. And you have an official saying, oh, well, you're not sick enough. You cannot have the medication. So it's extremely frustrating.
And what are officials saying about this, I guess, rationing of care is the right word here?
That's how a lot of critics of these policies put it. It's not easy, even for the Delaware's Medicaid director, Stephen Groff, who I connected with.
I don't think that we've ever been faced with a situation quite this unique where we had such a high-cost treatment for a high-volume number of patients.
So Delaware is a small state, but even treating about 150 people for hepatitis C last year, they spent over $13 million.
Wow.
Yeah, it's about 6% of their annual drug spending. And Groff estimates there are about 2,000 people with Medicaid who have Hep C. And when you think about it, Hep C is a really common disease. More than 3 million people nationwide have it. So it's hard to find the resources.
So what are they changing in Delaware? What do they want to do differently?
There are a lot of moving parts. Groff tells me initially there were just too many unknowns. Now, since the drugs have been out, there's new medical guidelines that affirm the effectiveness of them, that encourage early treatment. The federal government is having a closer eye on state policies, reminding Medicaid programs they have an obligation to provide medically necessary treatment. And Groff says there's been another moving part, and that is that more drugs have hit the market, and that means more competition.
The landscape has changed significantly over the last 3 years. The cost of the drugs themselves has come down considerably now that we have competition in the marketplace. The manufacturers also are willing to negotiate supplemental rebates with the states. So that substantial reduction in cost is really making it more feasible for us to have open access.
So with all of these moving parts, earlier this year, Delaware actually scaled back their restrictions on who can access the drugs to the point that now they're rolling out a policy that in the coming months and year, it'll get to the point where people who don't have any sign of liver damage will be able to qualify for these treatments in the state. So now Delaware's gone from being one of the stricter states to one of the more lenient ones.
And is this happening across the country in other states?
So it appears that a lot of states are starting to now review their policies. And in a handful, about 10, they are actually changing them. I talked with Kevin Costello. He's a lawyer that's actually been involved in lawsuits in this. He was getting ready to file one with Valerie Green in Delaware. He also has been part of a big one in Washington State. And he basically argues now that these Medicaid policies are actually discriminatory in terms of restricting who can get treatment.
The analogy that you could think about it would be to cancer, where if the scientific community came up with a cure for cancer and it was made available and approved by the FDA, there's very little doubt that payors would suggest that they're going to withhold the cure for cancer until it had metastasized in one's body. That's basically what's happening here with hepatitis C.
Ugh. Yeah, Alana, when you put it that way.
It's pretty harsh. I mean, hepatitis C is a disease that typically progresses over a long period of time. But again, new treatment guidelines do point to the cost-effectiveness and importance of early treatment. So it's tricky.
What about Valerie Green? What is going on with her now?
Well, Green's in Delaware, again, a state that's gone from being one of the strictest to more lenient states when it comes to treatment access. So she's reapplied and is feeling hopeful.
I was very excited.
And how will that affect you?
Hopefully I'll feel great and I won't have these symptoms any longer and I can get back to leading a normal life.
So you can kind of hear the smile in her voice there and her hopefulness. But in a lot of ways, this story goes beyond individuals like Valerie Green and even beyond hepatitis C. It's a common disease, but when we think about all the other drugs that are in the pipeline right now, a lot of other diseases that many patients are dealing with, it really heightens and brings forward attention right now that we as a country are facing and world when it comes to the cost of care and getting that treatment.
And what's the value of a cure?
Exactly.
Thank you so much, Alana.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Even though medical marijuana is available in nearly half of U.S. states, it remains on the federal level a Schedule I drug under the Controlled Substances Act. It's on the same list as heroin, LSD, and ecstasy. Advocates and lawmakers have pushed to get marijuana off that list since the 70s without success. The Obama administration just denied another such bid. This time it was led by two Democratic governors. So for now, the drug continues to be classified as having high potential for abuse, but no accepted medical uses. So that means researchers who want to study marijuana have to untangle a mess of red tape before they can get to work. Reporter Liz Reed takes us inside one of the few labs in the country where people are getting high with the federal government's blessing.
Inside a ventilated chamber made of plexiglass and steel sits a young man who's about to do something that in most circumstances would be against federal law.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm Liz.
I'm 15.
He introduces himself with his study ID number, 15, rather than his name, because he doesn't want the world to know he's smoking weed in the name of science. It's 8:45 in the morning, and number 15 looks like he just rolled out of bed. He's wearing a t-shirt and gym shorts, and his thick brown hair sticks out wildly in every direction. He sits down in an office chair, picks up the small metal pipe, and gets to work. The pipe is covered with a metal cap, so neither number 15 nor research assistant Muhammad Warraq knows whether it's a placebo or active marijuana inside. Warraq asks number 15 to tap the sides of the pipe with the lighter to make sure all the weed falls to the middle of the bowl. Each participant in this study has 10 minutes to ingest 10 milligrams of Delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol, more commonly known as THC, the psychoactive compound in marijuana. Number 15 isn't wasting any time. Every exhale is followed almost immediately by another hit on the pipe. He finishes in 7 minutes. He's part of a study funded by the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, or SAMHSA. Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences Ryan Vandry is running the study at the Behavioral Pharmacology Research Unit at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore.
So there's been a couple studies comparing drug effects and blood pharmacokinetics for smoking and vaporization, but no study has done all three, blood, urine, and saliva. And there's also been very little evaluation of different doses on drug effects and cognitive performance.
The three-story brick building where this research takes place wouldn't look out of place on any college campus. The inside is equally unremarkable. There are narrow, winding hallways with offices and small rooms, a staff kitchen. Scientists here study all kinds of drugs, from caffeine and nicotine to heroin and LSD. So security is tight. After number 15 is done smoking, Warraq takes the pipe he used to the pharmacy to make sure all the marijuana is gone.
So every door has a key card entry?
There are security guards at the building 24/7 and cameras all over the place. You have to have a badge just to get inside, and some doors, like the pharmacy, won't open for just anybody.
Hello? Hey, it's Muhammad.
I'm not allowed in the pharmacy, so I have to wait outside. A few people pass by me in the narrow hallway, giving me quizzical looks. It's not the kind of place you typically see reporters.
So what did they say?
They were good. We're good.
As we round the corner on our way back toward the smoking room, we see number 15 sitting on the ground with his head between his legs. Another research assistant stands next to him with a clipboard, looking worried.
You good? Very lightheaded. Very lightheaded? Okay.
In case you didn't hear that, number 15 says he's very lightheaded, which he'll have to note on the questionnaire he'll fill out about a dozen times over the course of the next 8 hours. He'll also have blood drawn, saliva sampled, urine collected, and vitals measured, and will complete cognitive tasks on the computer. All this happens in what's called the session room, which looks like the central hangout area in a college dormitory. There are TVs and couches, a kitchen, and even a pool table. He'll go through the whole procedure 6 different times on 6 different days, 3 times smoking, 3 times vaporizing with placebo, high dose, and low dose weed. Later on, after securing the right permissions, Vandry takes me inside the pharmacy and introduces me to pharmacist Olivia Hahn.
So Olivia does all the pharmacy work for us, handles storage, accountability, and preparation dispensing of the drugs.
The drugs are stored in a large vault that takes up almost one whole wall of the small pharmacy. Only Hahn and a handful of other Johns Hopkins pharmacists are allowed inside. Even Vandry's never been in there. Hahn hesitates when I ask if I can take a look.
I can show you, like, briefly. So those are steel container cabinets that they're in?
Yeah. So this is like still like vaulted door. It's really it has to be over a certain amount of weight.
The vault is mostly empty except for a couple of refrigerated steel cabinets in the corner. Inside one of those cabinets is the 20 grams of marijuana Vandry needs for his study, an amount that would fit inside a sandwich bag. The Drug Enforcement Administration requires that even small amounts of Schedule I drugs be stored in safes that weigh more than 750 pounds or are bolted or cemented to the floor. This vault exceeds those requirements, but Hahn says the DEA still comes to inspect the vault every time a new study starts, just to be sure. And storing the drugs is at the tail end of a long process of paperwork and permissions. For his study, Vandry had to go through a university ethics review and get approval from the Food and Drug Administration and the DEA. And there's a whole other mess of red tape to deal with to actually get the marijuana.
I contact the folks who are in charge of the NIDA drug supply. I let them know what I need. Then I have to submit a packet of information to them. It includes a DEA ordering form. It includes a copy of the protocol, the IRB approvals, the IND from the FDA, and a copy of my CV. And then, so all of that goes in a package to them. They review it, and they'll contact the federal agency approving the study.
Vandry says it took about 9 months to get the study off the ground. Given all the permissions, bureaucracy, and strict storage and security requirements, I imagine the drugs being delivered in some sort of armored vehicle.
Who delivers it? Like, it's not like UPS, right? It is?
FedEx.
FedEx. Wow. I would not have expected that.
That's right. After 9 months of legwork and half a dozen permissions, this Schedule I drug is delivered in a regular old FedEx truck. It's just one of many contradictions inherent in marijuana research. Nearly half of U.S. states have legalized the drug specifically for medical uses. Yet, according to the FDA, there are no medical uses for cannabis. Here's Vandry again.
And the DEA has no motivation to unschedule cannabis. And they're sticking with their no established medical benefit, I think, because the FDA hasn't approved it. And nobody's funding the trials to do that FDA would need to see to approve it. And so it's just, it's a quagmire. It's highly driven by politics, I think. It's driven more by emotion than it is by science.
While the DEA has once again rejected a request to reschedule marijuana, it is making one key change that could impact the pace of research. Currently, all the marijuana that Vandry and other scientists use in their research comes from just one farm at the University of Mississippi. The agency says it will soon begin licensing other farms to grow marijuana for academic and medical research, though it hasn't said when or how many. Meanwhile, the march of states legalizing marijuana for medical purposes continues at a pace far faster than scientists can prove that it actually works as a medicine. For The Pulse, I'm Liz Reed.
Liz is a reporter at our partner station, WESA, in Pittsburgh. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We have a regular feature on our show called Patient Files. There's a great one coming up in a little while. And people share often very intense stories of illness and recovery. We've heard about grueling chemo sessions, huge life-changing operations, what it's like to lose a sense. And sometimes when I'm listening, I have thought to myself, I couldn't live like that. I would just want to die. But this is, of course, a very difficult question to think about hypothetically. What could I live with? What could I not bear? A new study looked into those questions. Researchers interviewed patients who were in the hospital and asked them about different states of health. And it turned out many of those patients rated things like being confined to bed, having a breathing machine, having to rely on somebody else to go to the bathroom, or being in continent as equal to or worse than death. I talked to the lead researcher, Emily Rubin, from the University of Pennsylvania, and I asked her, what did we do with these findings?
Right. That is the question. It's obviously a complicated question. And I think what we hope that people will consider is how we can start thinking about these kinds of states that are not death but are potentially intolerable to patients, how we can start considering those more effectively in a variety, across a variety of settings.
Could that perhaps mean that if a patient has a very serious illness that is potentially terminal, that their physician has a conversation with them about, here are some paths and here are some potential outcomes? Which path do you want to choose, or where do you want to go?
Yes. And ideally, those conversations are happening now. I think in many cases they don't happen until very late, and the path of least resistance is always to do the next test and the next treatment. And it's harder to really take a step back and say, you know, what's likely to happen? What's the rest of your life likely to look like if we go down this road or this road? And I think the path of exercising restraint and trying to keep people out of the hospital and being more measured in what we do is a harder path, both because these are hard conversations to have and also because that trajectory is less clear.
It seems like what really worried patients, what becomes clear in their answers is that they are really worried about a loss of control.
Right. A large percentage of people rated incontinence as being worse than death. I imagine that many people focus on the loss of control they associate with that. I don't believe that if people had isolated incontinence and were otherwise able to take care of themselves, that they would necessarily prefer to die. I don't take that at face value, but I think it does speak to people's fear of losing control over their own life.
When you do a study like this, are you a little bit nervous? Because sometimes it could just be a conversation point, like, oh, people would rather be dead than being incontinent. And
yes.
And that's the end of it.
Yes, I think it's a good question. I think that's right. It's easy to sort of make this into a bullet point when it is, in my mind, an extremely complicated issue that deserves a lot of thoughtful consideration. There are lots of reasons that I don't take these data literally necessarily. I think they're important for what they say about people's tolerance of states of debility. And I think we know from this research and from previous research that there are many non-death outcomes that people would find equally or more unacceptable than death. So I think that's important.
Because I guess what you would have to tease apart is really what's behind your fear. Are you worried about being a burden to your loved ones? Are you worried about feeling ashamed or being embarrassed or not being able to participate in life anymore?
Right.
So what is really the it factor here?
Right. I think having meaningful conversations with patients about those issues is very important. It's equally important to figure out how do you translate a conversation like that into a decision about which way to go when there are two paths to go down. But if we can't find ways to take that information from patients and translate it into better practice that is going to, you know, make the care we deliver more consistent with the preferences that people express, then we're not making progress.
Emily Rubin is a research fellow in pulmonary and critical care at the University of Pennsylvania. Coming up, when summertime fun in the water park quickly turns into a nightmare.
One of the doctors told us what she had, exactly what she had, and he goes, "Do not look this up online." He goes, "It'll only scare you more."
That's still to come on The Pulse.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Our next story is about a man who was essential to our understanding of how memory works, though he himself was not able to remember any of his contributions, not the experiments he was the focus of that spanned more than five decades, not the researchers he saw day after day, year after year. Until his death in 2008, he was only known as Patient HM. His full name is Henry Mollison. His life is the subject of a new book titled Patient HM, A Story of Memory, Madness, and Family Secrets. The author, Luke Dietrich, has a very personal connection to this story. We'll get to that in a moment. But Luke started out by telling me about Mollison's epileptic seizures during childhood. They became absolutely debilitating as he got older.
By the time he was 27 years old, his parents and he himself were all very sort of desperate to find some sort of treatment, some sort of cure. And they turned to a neurosurgeon named William Scoville, who was a renowned neurosurgeon, a brilliant technical surgeon by all accounts. He taught at Yale, was the founder and director of the Hartford Hospital's Department of Neurosurgery. And he told them that he would like to perform an experimental operation on Henry. He proposed removing some deep-seated structures bilaterally in Henry's brain from Henry's medial temporal lobes, his hippocampus, amygdala, uncus, portions of them.
And Luke, what was the state of brain surgery at that time? That was, you said it was an experimental surgery, but had any been done? Did they know what they were doing?
You know, there were operations on this part of the brain that were done to treat epilepsy, but they were done only unilaterally. He, this surgeon, who I should say was my grandfather, Dr. Scoville, he had performed this same type of operation prior to the operation he performed on HM, but he had only performed it under sort of drastically different circumstances. He had performed it in asylums to treat psychosis and other forms of mental illness.
And were you able to speak to your grandfather about this story?
No, I never spoke with him about it. He died when I was 9 years old.
So what happened to Henry? The operation did not go as planned.
It did not go as planned. It pretty quickly became clear that Henry was no longer able to create new, you know, long-term memories. You know, the present moment would just sort of slide off of him. He lived the rest of his life, more than a half century, in more or less 30-second increments. It was a profound and devastating and catastrophic amnesia.
So describe that for us. If he met you, or if he met a new person, after 30 seconds, he would forget them again.
Yeah, I mean, one of the fascinating things about Henry was that on the surface, he could seem quite normal. You might have a conversation with him, and if the conversation didn't last all that long, you might not realize anything was wrong with him. But if you did step out of the room and came back in, you know, a minute, 2 minutes later, he would introduce himself to you, and it would be as though you'd never met.
And when did Henry become the subject of such intense study on memory?
A couple of years after the operation, so the operation took place in 1953, and a couple years later, there's a brilliant neuropsychologist who's still at McGill University, Brenda Milner. She's in her 90s now and is still an active researcher. She had a hunch at that point that these medial temporal lobe structures might be essential to long-term memory creation. And so she heard about this operation that my grandfather had performed on Henry, and she realized that Henry was a perfect test case, and she began conducting experiments with him. Ultimately, Henry was, in some senses, inherited by a student of Dr. Milner's named Suzanne Corkin, and she studied Henry for several decades until his death.
And when did you first realize your personal connection to this case?
The case of patient HM is something I've been sort of has been a part of my family lore for as long as I can remember. I think I always knew that this was a story that at some point I was going to have to tackle. The operation he performed on patient HM within my family, I think, was often sort of viewed as, you know, this one mistake he had made, and they thought it was unfortunate that people would focus on this mistake rather than on all the good that he had accomplished. What I discovered, though, is that it wasn't really an isolated mistake, and that in order to understand the story of patient HM, you really had to look at this, you know, long-term campaign of what's hard not to call, you know, human experimentation that was conducted in you know, the backwards of asylums and in hospitals around the country during the 1930s, 40s, and early 1950s, during this sort of psychosurgical era, which is when, you know, doctors believed that they could cure mental illness by lesioning specific parts of the brain. I found this chilling letter written by the head of the Department of Physiology at Yale University, who was trying to encourage another physiologist to spend time with my grandfather to study my grandfather's lobotomized patients. And he said, "You really should go and spend time with him because Dr. Scoville has been given unlimited access to the psychiatric material of this asylum." And I had to read it twice before I realized that psychiatric material meant human beings. I mean, these were viewed as disposable.
If we return to patient HM, what did we learn from him? What are some of the big findings that are tied to him?
Well, there are the two major findings that Brenda Milner discovered. One, that these particular structures in the brain are essential for long-term memory creation. Two, that there are two distinct and seemingly independent memory systems in the brain that HM could learn new tasks, even though he would never remember having learned them. He endured a lot, but a lot was built out of sort of his suffering. He taught us a huge amount about what memory, how memory works. I'd also say that a close look at his story, I found, is also illuminating, not just in terms of memory science, but in terms of how we go about pursuing our sometimes sort of ruthless quest for knowledge. I mean, I think that his case does raise some serious questions of research and medical ethics that should never be forgotten.
Luke, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Luke Dietrich is the author of Patient HM, A Story of Memory, Madness, and Family Secrets. Earlier this month, an 11-year-old girl from South Carolina died from parasitic meningitis, or what headlines refer to as brain-eating amoeba. They get to people's brain via the nose when water is pushed up into the nose. It's terrifying, and this parasite is found in warm waters. The 11-year-old was likely exposed while swimming in a river. The amoeba has since also been detected at a popular swimming hole in Grand Teton National Park. And while this is extremely rare, it's also extraordinarily deadly. In the U.S., there are only 3 documented survivors, according to the Centers for Disease Control. Our associate producer, Paige Flager, tracked down survivor number 3. And she produced this story about Kaylee Hardick and her father, Joseph. In the summer of 2013, the family was living in Arkansas, and Kaylee, who was 12 at the time, suddenly found herself fighting for her life.
We had been going to the water park all week long, and we would just go there, swim, and hang out, just like normal days. A lot of people would say I used to swim like a fish, because I'd love to be in the water. After we had got back home, I had started to have a terrible headache, and Mom thought it was just because I'd been swimming all day and I'd been sunburnt. So she said, well, it's getting late, so you probably just need to go to sleep, and we'll see how you feel in the morning.
Well, when Tracy went to get her up that Friday morning, she was just deathly ill. She could just tell.
That morning, I did not want to get out of bed. I mean, my head was killing me. I mean, I felt nauseous. I did not want to move. I remember Mom and taking me to the ER. I remember going in and, like, having my blood pressure taken and, I mean, having my lumbar puncture and stuff.
And the doctor wanted to do a spinal tap to eliminate any type of meningitis. And he was kind of thinking it could be bacterial.
And the weird thing about the lumbar puncture is they said it was going to hurt really bad. I didn't really feel anything.
When he done the spinal tap, they actually had a slide there on hand of parasitic meningitis, and it was a dead-on match. So that's when everything started rolling downhill. So the head doctor over the ER, well, after they realized what was going on, he come in, and he took myself and Tracy into a conference room and laid it out to us. He said, she won't make it through the weekend. You know, it's hard to wrap your head around. They give her a 1% chance of survival. And then I believe it was Saturday evening, Kaylee started having double vision. And that's an indication of her brain swelling. So they immediately went to the ER and done surgery and put kind of like a port in her head. So they said, this way we can put medicine directly into her brain and monitor her cranial pressure. They administered some medicine directly into her brain, and something happened. It got plugged or something. Kaylee was awake at the time, and her pressure started building, and she started to go out. She could tell she was becoming unresponsive and everything. And that's when the room just exploded. Boy, doctors come running in, and they put her on life support right then and there. And then they wanted to chill her body. They had these pads that would had water circulating through the pads, but they would stick to her lower extremities, her legs, and her trunk, her core, stick on her back and on her belly, and cool her body down. They could set it to a certain temperature. They had her body down to 93 degrees. They told us that the amoeba in water becomes active when the water's above 80 degrees. So if you would, you know, a normal human's temperature is 98.6. So if you cool that down, well, it's not going to help it any, so maybe it'd slow it down as well. And the reason they wanted it cooled off like that was so her body would rest. It'd be no stress or strain on anything. Her brain could relax. They put her in a medically induced coma for a little while, and then they wanted to start and slowly warm her body back up and see how her body reacted.
Once I woke up out of a coma, you know, we have the TV in the room, and, you know, news is on, and I'm all over the news.
We never told her exactly what happened, and she didn't really know. And then from watching TV and hearing things when people would come in, she started piecing things together, and then she asked us. So we told her, and then she didn't want to take a shower no more.
I was terrified of the shower because I thought that same bacteria, I mean, it was in every kind of water. Like, if I just took a shower, I'd get sick again, and I didn't want to go through that again. Once they let me swim in their pool at Children's, and I knew that I wouldn't get sick, like in a salt-treated or chlorine-treated pool, I was, like, ecstatic because I knew I could still swim, and I loved to swim.
Kaylee and Joseph Hardick talking about Kaylee's recovery from parasitic meningitis. Special thanks to journalist Peter Smith for putting us in touch with the Hardicks. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, Todd Bookman, and Irina Zhorov. Joel Wolfram is our intern, and this is his last week with us, so thanks, Joel, for all your hard work this summer. Adam Staniszewski was our engineer this week, filling in for Charlie Kyer. Paige Flager is our associate producer, Joel Patterson is our managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. Next week on The Pulse, Zach Conrad was found passed out on a bike trail.
He was on his side. I remember flipping him over and he was blue.
His heart had stopped beating, he was not breathing, and at the hospital, doctors put Zach on ice, literally.
We lower the core body temperature from normal 98.6 to around 91 to 92 Fahrenheit.
He had cool water blankets that sort of were underneath his legs and arms.
Death, ice, and resurrection. Don't miss that episode of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.